want to welcome this morning students from Prattville High. Would you please rise? Welcome. You'll be seated. And we have students from Watertown High School. Would you rise? Good. Thank you. And will you be seated? Now that the court has been introduced to you all, I would like to introduce the court to you. Starting on my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice John Wilcox, and to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abraham's Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage, and to his left, Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left, Justice Patrick Crooks. The students and others present in the court may pick up photographs of the court and synopses of the cases that you will hear this morning. The students will meet with retired Chief Justice Day at noon. We will discuss with you the procedures of the court and answer your questions. With that business out of the way, we'll turn to our first case, which is 95-2942, Dreschman's Mutual Insurance Company versus Robert Page. We will hear from David M. Victor, who represents Robert Page, the defendant respondent petitioners. Mr. Victor.
Well, please, the Chief Justice and Justices of the Court, I'm David Victor, and I represent the respondent, defendant petitioners, Robert Page, National Building Service.
I'm sorry to interrupt you this early, Mr. Victor, but you may be more comfortable if you would raise the podium and then we could hear you. If you will raise the podium, there's a button on your left on top. High tech.
Thank you. Can the court hear me okay now?
Yes, thank you.
May please the court, I'm David Victor, and I represent Robert Page, National Building Service, and CNA Insurance Companies, the defendant respondents petitioners in this matter. This matter is here on a petition for review of a Court of Appeals District 1 decision decided April 12, 1997. Which has now been reported at 212 Wisconsin 2nd, page 1, as well as page 568 Northwest 2nd, page 1. This is a narrow issue of law which is before this court for decision on the standard of review of de novo. That is, it's a legal issue requiring no deference to the reasoning or decisions of the lower courts. The narrow issue before this court today is a novel one because it's an issue of first impression. It's an issue arising from the statute, section 102.29, subsection 1 of the Wisconsin statutes, which deals with rights of workers' compensation insurers and injured worker recipients of workers' compensation benefits in third-party actions against third-party tortfeasors. The narrow issue in this particular case is, can a workers' compensation insurer who begins an action against a third-party defendant under that statute include the pain and suffering claims or attempt to recover the pain and suffering claims of the injured employee recipient of workers' compensation benefits when that employee has specifically declined to participate in the action and, in fact, that employee's rights have been extinguished under the statute of limitations. The position of the petitioner respondents' defendants is that it cannot be done because the law of the state of Wisconsin, as decided by this court, which affects this issue, is based on two decisions of this court. The 1986 case of Kotka versus PPG Industries, which case was reported at 130 Wisconsin 2nd, 499, 388 Northwest 2nd, 160, 1986. as well as a more recent case of 2 years ago, the case of Johnson versus ABC Insurance, which this court decided in 1995 and has reported at 193 Wisconsin 2nd 35, 532 Rutherford 2nd 130. In those two cases, this court has set forth a three-part test as to what the workers' compensation carrier may pursue and what the workers' compensation carrier may recover in this type of third-party action. You have to have, number one, an accident or injury, which, of course, we have in this case. The facts are simply that an employee fell in the parking lot of her employer's place of business. Number two, for death or injury to an employee, which we have in this case, and payments by the workers' compensation carrier. Number three is really the point of contention before the court today. The third part of that test is for which the workers' compensation carrier had liability to pay workers' compensation benefits under Chapter 102 of the Wisconsin statutes, which of course is also commonly known as the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act. I respectfully submit to this court that Gresherman's Insurance, the workers' compensation insurer in this case, has failed to meet the third prong of the test set out by this court and therefore cannot collect the pain and suffering claims of the non-participating employee injured worker. There's no dispute here that if, in fact, Gresherman's does prove that the injured worker was injured by the fault of the premises owner, which are Page and National Building Services, and that the negligence of those persons exceeded the negligence of the injured worker, Dorothy Gross, there's no question that the workers' compensation carrier will be able to recover what they paid and what they actually have liability for.
Let me ask you about this.
Yes. Because this will
help clarify some of your arguments for me. Is it your position that if Gresherman sues for all the money that it's paid out and might reasonably pay out or whatever the standard is for future workers' comp, and they obtain a judgment and collect from your client that amount, that they must then subject that amount to the distribution statute and then pay some of that money to the injured employee and in fact not receive the money that they've paid out in total?
That's exactly correct, Justice Geske. This comes under the formula that is set forth in Section 102.29, which calls for cost of collection, this much money, workers' compensation insurer, this much money, and one-third to the injured worker.
Well, let's take an example. How much money are we talking about in terms of what they pay out? About $60,000?
Approximately $75,000. I think it's between $60,000 and $75,000, which was paid for disability benefits, time off work, as well as medical payments.
All right, let's assume then that $80,000 or $90,000 total, let's say it's $90,000, that they are able to recover under your theory. They then must submit that to distribution, and how would that work under the distribution statute? How does that work? They could collect their costs, and they collect attorney's fees?
Right. They collect their costs, they collect their attorney fees. After the costs and attorney fees, the one-third and their...
Okay, so let's assume it's a third.
Okay, after all that's collected.
So then they could pay themselves $30,000 off
right.
the top. Then the next $30,000 would go to the employee.
An employee.
And so then what's left then is $30,000, and since they in fact paid out $90,000, they would only get $30,000 for that.
Right.
And they would be out the other $60,000.
And there'd be a cushion that would go. That's one of the
cushion. What cushion?
The cushion is explained in the WC 170 formula. There's never any mention of a specific cushion in the statute itself, but the cushion is the amount that comes off the bottom. If there is any money left, that money goes to the injured employee.
No, the point I think of Justice Getsky's example is that in this case,
right.
of the $90,000, the company will only get $60,000.
Right.
Well, actually $30,000. I mean,
right.
Yeah. Okay, but the total will be $60,000, even though under the facts of this scenario, the company expended $90,000 for the employee and plus other sums for the cost of the litigation. So just out of pocket to the employee, they have $90,000, yet they're only going to recover $60,000. So they're short.
Right.
And the employee is overpaid.
The answer to that, Chief Justice, is by looking at the flip side of what the typical scenario is. The typical scenario is that under 10229, the workers' compensation insurer just sits around with its hands out waiting for its money, whereas the injured employee goes out and hires an attorney, the injured employee takes depositions, the injured employee tries the case, the injured employee comes up with, say in this case, the injured employee comes out with a settlement or judgment of only $30,000. In that situation, the distribution still goes to the workers' compensation carrier, which didn't participate, but the workers' compensation carrier gets a shortfall. It's the same situation.
But the problem I have with that is that at least in that situation, the tortfeasor has paid the total of his or her responsibility for causing the injury. In the scenario you're giving, the insurance company, the subrogated workers' comp carrier, is not going to be reimbursed fully for its expenses, and the tortfeasor benefits from that by virtue of the requirement that they not be able to sue for pain and suffering under your theory, and secondly, that they not be able to, that they have then have to pay something to the plaintiff. I mean, it's not a matter of the workers' comp carrier getting a windfall, it's a matter of the tortfeasor not having to pay the full amount.
The situation, Justice, is that the third-party tortfeasor is, in fact, paying the full amount. The amount the tortfeasor has been paid for is $75,000. They have never been sued for pain and suffering of the injured worker.
And that's the fundamental issue here.
That is the fundamental issue here, exactly correct. In fact, I would quote a line from the Kotka case from this court that says, the statute does not permit employers or their insurers to invade claims which belong to the employee only. So if we had a case here, Justices, in which the injured worker had participated in the case, had hired her own attorney, had filed personal claims, she would have the right to recover that money. If there is, in fact, a shortfall that turns out to the workers' compensation carrier, I respectfully submit that this is a legislative problem. It's not a judicial problem. This is how the statute is worded. This is how the statute is set up.
Well, what part of the statute? I'm reading the employer. This is from 102.29.1. The employer or compensation insurer who shall have paid or is obligated to pay a lawful claim under this chapter, that sounds like Gresham, right? Shall have the same right to make a lawful claim under this chapter, shall have the same right to make claim or maintain an action in court against any other party for such injury or death. If you read that, you can easily say that the employer steps in, or the carrier here, steps into the shoes of the injured employee, Gross, and can do whatever Gross could do. And Gross could sue for pain and suffering. Why can't Thresham?
That, Chief Justice, is, in fact, the cornerstone of my opponent's argument.
And can you speak up, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry. And the reason that cannot be done, in view of what the statute says and the way the case law interprets it, is that the reason is that the third party tortfeasor is only paying out what it owes, and in fact the personal claims belong personally to the injured employee.
Let's stay with that language, because I think that portion of the statute is critical to this case. And let's look at the word claims, and I think that's what you have to focus on. The language that the Chief Justice just read, the employer or compensation insurer who shall have paid or is obligated to pay a lawful claim under this chapter. In your opinion, is the insurance company obligated to pay a claim for pain and suffering under this chapter?
No, it is not, Justice Bradley.
How do you define the word claim right at that point in the sentence? Do you define it as a claim for pain and suffering, a claim for temporary total disability, a claim for medical expenses, or do you define that claim as a broader, a more generic claim, as in a claim or cause of action?
Justice Bradley, that claim is the claim that each one of those parties has the right to bring. There is nothing anywhere in the statute that gives them the same right or grounds of recovery. That is nowhere in the statute. All it says in the statute is the right to pursue the same claim.
Okay, my question is narrow. My question is, how do you define claim as used in the phrase is obligated to pay a lawful claim under this chapter? Do you define it narrowly as in a specific claim, or do you define it generically in your argument?
I define it narrowly as defined by this court in the Kotka case and the Johnson case. That is, from the workers' compensation viewpoint, a claim is something it has paid for an employee injury or death for which it had liability. The claim, on the other hand, of a participating employee would be a claim that would include personal claims such as pain and suffering, such as loss of consortium, which this court specifically barred as being something the workers' compensation carrier can dig into as part of the settlement in the Burnham Moore versus Jones case. So claim is narrowly defined. Both parties do have a right to make a claim. That's what the statute says. However, the statute says nothing about both parties having the right to pursue the exact same rights of recovery, or to pursue rights of recovery of people who choose not to participate in the case.
What does the complaint in this case look like?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice, are you asking what the allegations of the complaint are?
Mm-hmm.
The allegations of the complaint are Thresherman's Insurance alone, with Dorothy Gross as an involuntary plaintiff versus National Building, Robert Page, and CNA Insurance. There's really no mention made in there of the Ms. Gross, the involuntary plaintiff, having any claim for pain and suffering, for loss of consortium, for anything like that. The complaint in its entirety addresses the rights of Thresherman's.
No, but what does it say? Does it say that it is an insurance company, that it's the workers' compensation carrier for the XYZ employer, that Ms. Gross was an employee, she was injured, that her injury consisted of blank, blank, her medicals were blank, pain and suffering was blank, and they're demanding judgment for blank.
No, actually, Chief Justice, the only thing they asked for was they said, we pay Dorothy Gross X number of dollars for disability time off work, we paid her X number of dollars for her medical expenses, we therefore are claiming that amount of money that we the insurance carrier, paid to Dorothy Gross from these third-party tort users. There's nothing about Dorothy Gross's personal claims in that complaint.
Is that typical?
I'm sorry?
Is that typical?
It's the first case I've ever seen of it, and I've been doing 102.29 cases on both sides for a few years, and this is why I call this the case of first impression, because this court and the Court of Appeals of this state have decided several 102.29 cases. But this is the very first time this type of situation has come up. We have a number of cases that have come up where the workers' compensation carrier doesn't participate and the employee does. A classic example is the Elliott case, in which this court said that the workers' compensation carrier doesn't have to participate, but they're bound by whatever the recovery is.
How do you distinguish Kotka In Katka, the court held, as I understand it, that in that case where a claim was brought by the injured husband who subsequently died and then maintained by his estate, an estate maintained the claim for pain and suffering, as I understand those facts, and allowed the workers' compensation carrier to share under the 102.29 formula in the proceeds of that portion which included pain and suffering. How do you distinguish Katka from your case?
Because, Justice, Katka is a case in which the claimant, or as it happened to be, the estate of the deceased worker, actively participated in the case. Now, when an injured worker brings a lawsuit, they're allowed to recover their medical benefits. They're allowed to recover their lost wages, past and future. And that is something that the workers' compensation carrier is allowed to recover, is allowed to, so to speak, dig into. It's the pot they're allowed to take their recovery out of. Whereas if you have the flip side in this case, where the workers' compensation carrier is the only one bringing the suit, the only thing they can pursue is what's under the statute, which is what they have actually paid and what they actually have liability for. That's where the difference lies.
Does that seem fair, depending on who sues? If the employee joins in the lawsuit, the insurance company comes out very well. The employee doesn't join, the insurance company doesn't get credit. And isn't there any rules about how the employee should help out the insurance company here?
There's no rules. That goes by the Elliott case. If you don't participate, you just have a right to dig into what is in there. But the party that participates can pursue what they have pursued, what they have a right to pursue. And with all due respect, Chief Justice, the question of what's equitable, what's fair, isn't really a relevant consideration. That was specifically said in the Campion case. That's Campion versus Montgomery Elevator. It was a Court of Appeals case cited at 172 West 2nd, 405 in 1992. And there's been a couple of other places. The Elliott case has addressed that issue. The question of what's fair and what's equitable is not relevant to this discussion. What's relevant is the scheme of the statute.
Well, counsel, I agree that it's the legislature that determines what's fair and equitable, and I agree that the statute prevails. But we've got a statute that can be interpreted with you or against you. And when you want to interpret a statute, one concept is the legislature intended this scheme to be equitable.
The way to interpret a statute, I would say, Chief Justice, is to prevent outrageous or runaway results. What would happen, for instance, in this case, if the workers' compensation carrier were allowed to pursue pain and suffering of the injured employee? And say a jury went berserk, as juries can sometimes do, and they gave her $5 million for her pain and suffering.
You'd ask that the verdict be reduced, counsel.
I would ask that the verdict be reduced.
You have authority to do that.
But that's a matter of the discretion of the court.
Okay. So now the verdict is in the $5 million
okay.
And it's upheld. Okay.
Then I return the question, what happens? Is that fair to the workers' compensation? Is that fair to the third-party defendant to have to defend against the case that nobody ever brought against them?
But that's not true. The workers' comp carrier brought it against
them. They never brought a case for pain and suffering.
Well, they did. The question is whether they can. It all gets down to whether or not they can make the claim under the statute for pain and suffering, because if the answer is yes, they can, then everything's fair. Because if a workers' comp carrier stands in the shoes of the plaintiff, of the injured party, they can make the claim. The tortfeasor isn't going to pay any more than they're legally responsible to, and there's nothing unfair about it. I mean, it's a circular argument, and it gets down to whether or not this statute 102.29 sub 1 allows the employer comp carrier to stand in the shoes of the plaintiff.
Well, Justice Getty, you talk about, and the Chief Justice also talked about, what's fair. Is it fair to the third-party tortfeasor to know they have a right to know where the other party is coming from also. They have a right to know that the statute is not being interpreted in a way that has no logical stopping point. There's no logical stopping point to the interpretation that pressure
is. Why is that?
Because if they can bring pain and suffering, they could also bring loss of consortium. They could also bring any number of personal claims.
Loss of consortium is somebody else's claim, not the employee's claim. I think there's a case to settle that. So the stopping point is the stopping point in law, namely, what can an injured person sue a tortfeasor for? That's your stopping point.
I think that was addressed in the case of Smith versus Long, because in that case, the injured employee hired a lawyer. The lawyer didn't get out the lawsuit in time. As a result, they lost their right to sue. They brought an action against the lawyer to recover legal malpractice. And the workers' compensation carrier said, well, that's part of our money, because that's money they're recovering from the third part, from the tort injury, from the workers' comp injury. And the court said, no, it's not, because that is not the type of claim for which the workers' compensation carrier had benefits.
What?
There really is only one way to interpret that statute, which is that the workers' comp carrier can only recover for paying those things for which it actually had liability. They never paid for pain and suffering in this case, and they never had any liability to pay for pain and suffering in this case. Why should they be permitted to recover it? And let's talk about what's fair and what's equitable. Why should they be allowed to recover that in an effort to, so to speak, sweeten the pot over what the statute allows them to have?
Thank you, Mr. Victor. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Representing Gresham's Mutual Insurance Company, James Ratcliffe.
Thank you. May it please the court, Attorney Victor. My name is Jim Ratzel, representing Gresham's. I want to start off where Attorney Victor gave a little example. That $5 million jury award, two important points about that. Number one, if the tortfeasor caused the injury, it's fair that the tortfeasor pay $5 million. As defense lawyers, both Attorney Victor and I would cringe at a $5 million award, but nevertheless, that's fair. More importantly, under that example, $5 million, Threshman still, by law, is only going to get $60,000 to $70,000. So long as that distribution scheme is in effect, and so long as this court upholds the distribution scheme, Threshman's can never make a profit or can never have unjust enrichment, as Attorney Victor had argued in his brief. By statute, a comp carrier is limited to recovery of those benefits it has paid or that may have liability to be paid.
The balance goes to the injured party.
The balance would go to the injured party. In this particular case, even though if Dorothy Gross does not wish to participate, if we go to trial and the jury awards $5 million, Dorothy Gross is going to get several million dollars. Threshman will not recover a dime more than what it has paid or what it may be obligated to pay. The other important couple important points need to be remembered with this pain and suffering argument. Absent pain and suffering, there is no way for an insurance company to be made whole in this type of litigation. This is an administrative creation of the legislature, the workers' compensation system. What they set forth is a distribution scheme. If Threshman's is limited to recovery of $60,000 or $70,000, as I think Justice Geske pointed out, automatically we are going to have to pay Dorothy Gross a third of the recovery.
But counsel, I think of a case that recently came out about a little less than 2 months ago, Vogel versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. And that in that case, the Court of Appeals discussed a little bit of what is unique about workers' comp in establishing premiums against their policyholders. Workers' comp is based on experience of claims. It's unique from any other kind of insurance. In other kinds of insurances, the actuaries take a look at the general picture and they make the insurer pay premiums on the general picture. In workers' comp,
you have premiums based on your past experience as audited. And by experience, I mean if the insurance company has to pay those claims, they, in the past, they get those premiums from the enhanced premiums and from the policyholder. The case of Vogel talks about the increase in the experience modifier. So they're going to be made whole. I should say that this isn't their only chance on being made whole, because if they don't make it up in the third-party suit, they make it up in the retroactive audit and application of something like an enhanced modifier for enhanced premiums against the policyholder. Yes?
I would agree with you to some extent. Now, I'm not experienced in underwriting, but I don't think it's a dollar-for-dollar trade-off. I agree that their premium increases as the monies are paid out. That's the nature of the comp system as opposed to other types of insurance. But the fact remains, like in this particular case, Threshman's has paid out $60,000, $75,000. I would doubt, though I have no basis for it, but I would doubt that the premiums paid by this particular insured has been $60,000 to $75,000. It's probably a good chunk of money.
I mean, who knows? But they may be enhanced by $10,000 or $12,000 or $20,000, the amount which under a 102-29 formula they wouldn't be reimbursed if the recovery was $90,000 as positive, sure. Just discussed it.
The other point too is, aside from Threshman's inability to be made whole, we need the question. As under the workers' comp system, because this was a work-related injury, we are on the hook for this person's medical bills and indemnity for the rest of her life, for all practical purposes. If she has additional surgery, this was a hip replacement, if she has additional surgery 10 years down the road, Threshman's is going to have to pay out another $25,000 to $30,000 for those expenses, plus any other associated indemnity.
Let me just stop you here. The trial court, if I remember it, didn't allow you to make proof of potential future medical expenses, but the Court of Appeals did.
Correct.
And your briefs, neither party's briefs here, challenge the Court of Appeals' decision relating to future meds.
Correct.
So you could have collected from the defendant here an estimate of future meds. It could be high, it could be low, but you collected that, or I can collect that if your proof is right.
That's
right. So this case only involves pain and suffering, not meds. I just want to clarify.
You are correct.
Okay.
The reason that it's important is by recovering additional sums above and beyond what we have currently paid, we give ourselves a cushion.
Right.
So
you have that cushion.
Well,
on future meds.
Well,
it just may be, it's a guess. And it
but
may
it's,
be
it's a difficult
sure.
guess. If you go in front of the jury, and if I go in front of the jury and say, it's highly speculative, but this person may or may not need surgery in the future, that jury may very well not award future medical.
I'll give you a small amount, and it turns out to be large. Let me just, I just want to clarify the meds, but let me just ask you this. I'm disturbed by the fact that Ms. Gross, although invited to and given the opportunity to participate, maybe make $5 million here, or 4-point-something million, declines. That's her prerogative, right? She may say, look, I got everything I deserved. I don't agree with the tort injury system in this country. I think it's all out of whack. I don't want to be a participant in this. She may think that it's unfair to suck it to the partner people. She may not want to get on the witness stand. She may not want to be cross-examined. She may not want to, if she's a participant here, she may be subject to physical examination, right? She may not want any of that.
Correct.
And if you should prevail, then she can be a witness at call, right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear
you. If you should prevail here, and this goes to trial, this criminal trial, can she be called as a witness? Can she be subjected to physical examination?
Absolutely.
Now, well, why should we do that to Ms. Gross? She's had enough. She's had a hip replacement. She doesn't want any part of the legal system.
Because she's accepted our benefits. If she had said to Threshman's, I don't want your workers' compensation benefits. Threshman would not be involved in this case.
Well,
she didn't decline accepting the benefits.
Well, where does it say in the statute or in the cases that just because she takes your benefits, she's now got to sue for pain and suffering?
Where it does is the legislature created the Workers' Comp Act. They created this system, and in creating this system which required Threshman to pay this worker regardless of fault, they also said to Threshman's and other workers' compensation carriers, here's your avenue for recovery. It's 102.29.
Didn't they also say in 1911 when they created this system? Let's not deal with pain and suffering. Hey, part of the trade-off is you get quick payment. There's a no-fault system. You have, we're going to get arguably less in terms of benefits. You have scheduled and unscheduled injuries. But we're not obligated, nor are we going to pay for any claim for pain and suffering. That has nothing to do with the workers' comp system. Don't come to me if you want a claim for payment, if you want payment for a claim of pain and suffering. Wasn't that part of the trade-off?
I think what they did is they incorporated two different types of benefits. They incorporated the TTD, the temporary total disability, is to compensate for the lost wage. However, in this case, we've paid 50% permanent partial disability. Now, in my opinion, that is incorporating the disability this worker has sustained. That includes her pain and suffering.
The case that we wrote last year, Hagen defined permanent disability a bit differently. It's loss of function. Permanent disability benefits as including pain and suffering, and I'd like you to show me any authority, statutory or case, that says pain and suffering is part of permanent disability.
Because when that witness, plaintiff, injured worker is up on the stand in a normal case, and that person tells the jury, I can no longer bend over, the jury all is asked on the verdict form, past pain and suffering. The jury just writes in the dollar amount.
Yeah, my question, counsel, is a bit more specific. Do you have any statutory or case authority to cite for the proposition that permanent partial disability, PPD, encompasses the concept of pain and suffering?
Not right offhand. I don't.
Counsel?
Sure.
I'd like to get in a question here on the meds. Maybe to broaden my understanding of the law. Neither of you challenged you prevailed. You're able to ask the jury to present a claim for future medical payments. Now, if you recovered, let's say the jury awarded $100,000, does that go into the distribution formula?
If the total award is $100,000, whether it's medicals or past pain and suffering, it all goes into the distribution formula. What will happen then is the top third is usually for...
I understand that. Let's say 10 years from now, she has no medical payments to make. Then suddenly, as a result of the injury, she incurs $50,000. Now, theoretically then, as I understand the answer to your question, to my question before, she's already got that money under the distribution plan. What happens if she goes to you and says, hey, I've got a $50,000 doctor bill, pay it?
Routinely what happens is that there's this cushion, and everyone calls it a cushion, but in theory, under the law, the comp carrier could actually keep the money in with trust for future benefits. What normally happens is the worker is allowed to get the money to use for the worker's purposes. What would happen in your scenario is 10 years from now, someone would open the file and say, all right, Dorothy Gross had a cushion of $27,500. The medical bills are $30,000, so Ms. Gross, here's $2,500. They will already factor in that cushion because that's recorded and it's approved by the court of record. So all parties will be aware that there is this cushion sitting out there. Again, everyone's made whole under that scenario. The problem, if you suddenly remove that and remove the ability of the comp carrier to get more than what it currently has paid out, the comp carrier, 10 years from now under your example, is going to suddenly have to be paying bills, and probably it's going to be extremely difficult, and I know all your experienced jurors with juries, it's going to be extremely difficult to convince a jury that 10, 15, 20 years from now, she may or may not have problems, but you have to award us enough money to cover the fact in the event that she does. That argument is not going to fly in front of a jury. The other concern I had in this was...
Mr. Ratzel, let me interrupt and ask you a couple of questions also. Number one, how did this issue get before the trial court? Was there a motion in limine?
Yes. Attorney Victor had presented a motion, if I'm correct, to limit or preclude me from introducing any evidence of pain and suffering as well as, I believe, the future medical.
Let me ask you, Attorney Victor argued from Kotka and from Johnson, and he talked about a three-part test which is set forth in those cases, and he said you don't meet the third part, that being for which the workers' compensation carrier had liability, and obviously he's focusing on pain and suffering in that regard. How do you answer that?
I answer that by identifying, I think Kotka and Johnson actually agree and support our position. There's language in Kotka which references those injuries which flow from, maybe it's a Nelson, I believe, it might be Nelson, that flow from the injury in question. The way this distribution scheme was set up in 10229, they're allowing both sides simply one day in court. All claims and all liability of the tortfeasor, and I would quote from the Act, if notice is provided, the liability of the tortfeasor shall be determined as to all parties having the right to make a claim, irrespective of whether or not all parties join in prosecuting the claim. The only claim that would not fall under the distribution scheme, as the court has recognized in the past, would be those that are outside of the workers' compensation injury. In other words, the loss of society claim, the loss of consortium claim. Those are classic claims that are outside of the workers' comp benefits. However, those claims that naturally flow from the work-related injury, the lost wages, the medical expenses, the pain and suffering, the legislature specifically gave the carrier an avenue to recover those benefits. And that's all we are utilizing is that avenue. And that's been the history and the practice of compensation carriers over the years.
Well, if we apply the language literally from Kotka and from Johnson, you have a problem, don't you? If the language is literally taken as for which the workers' compensation carrier had liability, you didn't have liability. Freshermans didn't have liability for pain and suffering.
We don't have liability for pain and suffering, but how is the jury going to address that question in terms of when the jury is given the verdict? They're not going to be asked, did Threshermans correctly award the correct amount of permanent partial disability? They're going to be asked, what is the pain and suffering of the worker? So the jury then will determine the liability, and then the court will simply apply the distribution scheme. Otherwise, procedurally, and this is one of the reasons why we brought the interlocutory appeal, is I did not know how this verdict was going to be structured. Because the jury can't be told that by statute my client had to pay 50% PPD because of a hip replacement, and that necessarily equated to $62,350.
Counsel, is there any loss of future earnings in the component? I mean, that's the way I would envision it.
There can be.
And if there is, because that's what PPD, permanent partial disability, at least as referenced in the Hagen decision, that's what it's about. How that your disability, how your physical impairment impedes your ability to earn. Workers' comp is all about earning past wages, future wages. And so to the extent on the verdict, if that's your concern, that there is a question concerning future loss of earning capacity, there's a cushion, and that's directly related to a future or past permanent partial disability.
Except that in this case, we had to pay a 50% PPD because it's a hip replacement. I think in that we don't have the medical evidence.
50% of the hip, you mean?
Right. This woman probably could have returned to her job within a couple of months after the hip replacement due to the miracles of modern science. So if the jury is presented with that, how do you explain to the jury that she only missed 2 months of work, and yet we had to pay out $62,500 because the legislature said you have to pay 50% PPD anytime there's a full hip replacement?
Well, my sense is that what you paid or didn't pay should not enhance the value of the injury claim.
It doesn't. It doesn't enhance the value because there's only going to be one trial in this case. That trial is going to determine the liability of the tortfeasor for what injury and damages the tortfeasor caused. And that trial also is going to determine among all the plaintiffs whether it's the carrier or the injured worker. That's why the statute is quite clear in terms of saying the liability of the tortfeasor shall be determined as to all parties having a right to make claim irrespective of whether or not they join in the action. There's not going to be two different trials, one for the comp carrier and one for the injured worker. In this particular case, whether the jury awards $10,000 or $100,000 or $5 million, it's going to do so on the evidence of the case, not whether the plaintiff is a corporate plaintiff or whether it's a private citizen.
Are you finished answering?
Yes.
I want to get back to Justice Crook's question, because you didn't answer it to my satisfaction.
All right.
Justice Crook points to the language in COCTA that says, quote, applies to all claims in tort for an employee's injury or death for which the employer or its insurer has or may have liability. Now, if you prevail in this action and I have to write this decision, I have to look at that language and I have to somehow distinguish it. Are you saying that I should disregard that language or say that we really didn't mean it when we said it? Or what do we do with that language?
No, because I look at COTCA on page 515, the very next page, where the court determines that his claim for pain and suffering falls within the category of claims to which section 102.29 applies. The COTCA decision specifically states on page 515, given these circumstances, we conclude that Williams' claim for pain and suffering falls within the category of claims to which section 102.29 applies. I think the COTCA court correctly identified that I agree with the courts. Pain and suffering, those words are not specifically utilized in the Workers' Compensation Act. However, the statutory scheme established by the legislature created this avenue and said to the comp carrier, here is your method of recovering benefits. You stand essentially in the same shoes as the worker. You have to give the worker notice. But whether the worker brings the suit or whether you, the carrier, brings the suit, there's only going to be one action, and the liability of that tortfeasor is going to be determined only once as to all parties. And that system makes sense.
Counsel, in this case, of course, the statute of limitations has run with regard to any claim that the injured party may wish to bring on her own for pain and suffering. I believe by looking at the dates that at the time she filed the lawsuit, it would have been possible for her to yet bring a claim for pain and suffering. But let me ask you in a hypothetical. If you, as an insurance carrier, workers' comp insurance carrier, brought your claim beyond the 3-year period. First of all, can you do that?
I don't think I can. I, to be honest, I haven't researched that, and that hasn't come up. I don't think I can, though, because the statute that applies to the tortfeasor, he or she's entitled to the same protection as the statute. So I don't think I can, but continue.
My second part, I wanted to return to the statute, because I see this as kind of a statutory interpretation for case. And again, looking at the language focused upon earlier, the language in 102.29 sub 1 that says the employer or compensation insurer whom shall have paid or is obligated to pay a lawful claim under this chapter. Do you define claim narrowly or generically?
I define it broadly as referring to the sentence right above that where it gives the worker the making of a claim for compensation against an employer shall not affect the right of an employee to make claim or maintain an action in tort. Then it goes on to say, the very next sentence is, the employer or compensation carrier shall have the same right. So I see that as just saying, referring to the prior sentence, saying the worker is given this right to sue a third-party tortfeasor. You, the comp carrier, we give you the same right. And then it's further on down, it reads, again, as I've repeated, the liability of tortfeasor is determined to all parties. When 102.29 is read as a whole, it makes all the sense in the world. It's the legislature saying the worker has a right to maintain an action. They can join the comp carrier. The comp carrier has a right to maintain an action. It can join the worker. However, if neither one wants to participate, that still doesn't affect the rights of the parties and the liability of the tortfeasor.
That language, then, that I just quoted, if I ask the question, the employer or compensation insured who shall have paid or is obligated to pay a lawful claim under this chapter, have you paid a claim for pain and suffering under this chapter?
We have paid a claim under the chapter. Now, whether it's pain and suffering, no, not specifically worded as pain and suffering, but we have paid out benefits, and the legislature has said to us, since you have paid out benefits, here's your avenue of recovery, and we are pursuing that avenue. It's an avenue that, even using your example, the statute of limitations question, Attorney Victor indicated Dorothy Gross's claim is extinguished. It's not extinguished. If I prevail at the trial, I still have to pay her money. This court would be taking new ground, and I'm not sure I would be opposed to it, if the worker doesn't participate, the comp carrier gets to keep all the money and doesn't have to pay for the benefits. That would be a popular decision, but I don't see the court doing that.
Among insurance companies.
That's right. It would be popular among workers, too, if they could exclude out that comp carrier, too.
Well, let me return to that. As I read these cases, which include Kotka and Nelson, and I think Johnson too, in those cases, the employee is bringing the third-party action.
Correct.
The employee recovers a substantial amount of money. Employee recovers the pain and suffering in one, that I think was Kotka. In Nelson, the employee recovers for, what is it, gastro?
It was a claim that was originally denied by the insurance.
Yeah. It was an intestinal claim.
Right.
They had recovered for X from the insurance company, but not Y. They go to the circuit court against the third party, and the employee recovers for this other claim, to which compensation carrier has always denied recovery and has won. And in all those cases, the employee says, okay, let's cut out the workers' comp carrier. And in all these cases, the court says no. In all the cases, the workers' comp carrier shares, because the court says there was a claim for which there was workers' comp, meaning an injury generally that came out. This is just the opposite, isn't it?
Correct.
And you think the same rule should apply?
I think the same rule should apply, because whether you are the comp carrier or the worker, the legislature has given you only one avenue of opportunity to recover, and this is it.
And you think that the same interpretation of what that injury is, namely not the particular claims for damages, but generally that there was an accident at that time.
As long as it's unique to the worker and flows from the work-related injury, both parties should have a right to share.
Now, that hasn't appealed to me, but I'm still distressed at forcing the employee to participate in this kind of personal injury action when she doesn't want to. And the other one, you know, the insurance company is not going to have to bear its soul or its physical condition. We're just talking about money with the insurance company. It's a passive player in those other cases, right?
That's correct, but this
here, she's not a passive player. I mean, she's passive in the sense she doesn't have to hire an attorney necessarily or do anything, but she's really become a victim twice.
But this one
is in workers' comp and once in the court system. Why should we victimize her twice?
Because she's not forced no more than you or I, if we witnessed an automobile accident and said we don't want to get involved, and suddenly we're subpoenaed.
Let me ask you a question, and maybe it's in response to the chief's questions a little bit. Does the fact that if the workers' comp carrier is precluded from making any other claim other than the medical bills that Cook has paid out, does that necessarily preclude that the injured worker won't have to submit to a medical exam or won't have to testify during the trial?
She would have to, because she would have to if we want to recover one dime, because otherwise where do we get the evidence that indeed she was injured in the circumstances of the injury?
Well, she might have to submit the medical exams as to whether those medical tests were a necessary part of the
absolutely.
The
there were, absolutely.
Not the doctor.
Pardon me?
Not the doctor.
Not the doctor. Both. Probably the doctor is like any other personal injury action. You're going to have the patient. You're going to have the doctor. You're going to have witnesses to the accident. It's going to be no different than any other personal injury.
I'll tell you what bothers me, and it's a follow-up on this. In other contexts, we have said your claim for pain and suffering is something very personal. It's personal to you. You look at the divorce cases, and we have, in fact, in a case that Justice Steinmetz wrote, he says, nothing is more personal than the entirely subjective sensation of agonizing pain, mental anguish, embarrassment because of the scarring or disfigurement and outrage. And the case goes on to say, no, that this isn't the uninjured spouse's claim. You can't get this pain and suffering money in a divorce because it's so personal to the injured employee, to the injured party in the divorce. And the same thing in wrongful death cases. We say, let's say the husband dies, we say, wife, you can't bring claim for pain and suffering of your dead husband. It's your husband who's now dead, so only the estate who stands in the shoes of the deceased can bring it. So our other cases, our other areas of law say pain and suffering, just like the language in the Krebs case, is so personal that no one else can have it except the injured party. And now you're saying here, the injured party doesn't want to be part of a lawsuit for whatever reason, and we're saying, but we can give this personal claim of pain and suffering that in other areas we said we can't touch to the workers' comp insurance carrier.
The only the only reason I'm doing that is because the law requires me to share those proceeds with the injured worker. If this court were to tell me I don't have to share those proceeds with the injured worker would be nowhere near the courtroom. But as long as the law requires me to give a third of the recovery to the injured worker, I have no choice but to try to recover enough money so I can both pay my client and also reimburse the one-third to the injured worker. Right now, the legislature has set forth this scheme with this statutory distribution. And if I were to come before this court 2 years from now trying to lock out the injured worker saying, I don't want to give her the one-third because she didn't share, the court would be citing to me the long list of cases in which the court has said you have to share with that worker or the worker has to share with the carrier regardless of their participation.
Mr. Ratzel, your time is up.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Victor?
Very briefly, I'd like to go back to a question that was raised by the court. I think it was raised by both Justice Crooks and Justice Babich about the issue of that third prong of that test not being satisfied. And I think it was Justice Babich that asked my opponent if doesn't the Cotton case say what it says? And in fact, my opponent mentioned something from page 15, 515 of that decision, which was taken totally out of context, in my opinion. Said, only if the it said that the pain and suffering claim is part of the overall recovery. Yes, it certainly is, but only if the injured worker participates in the suit and pursues that pain and suffering claim. The other thing I wanted to bring up, and I guess we're revisiting the fairness issue for a minute.
If she depreciates in her health 2 years hence, she still got a claim against the workers' comp carrier?
She still has a claim. That's correct, Justice Steinmetz. And that really underscores what I'm about to say about the fairness issue. If we think the statute is unfair, or if the workers' comp carrier is up here complaining, this isn't fair because we don't get all our money or we get a shortfall or some of the money has to go to her, that's not a court problem. That's a legislative problem. And I don't mean to sound like a broken record by saying that, but let's take a look at that statute of limitations. Section 102.17, subsection 4, gives the injured employee a 12-year statute of limitations to bring a workers' comp claim. The workers' compensation carrier is bound by the same 3-year statute of limitations that any injured party has against the tortfeasor. So let's say somebody is injured in 1990. The injured worker has until 2002 to bring her workers' comp claim. But if the workers' comp claim, carrier pays that claim off in 2000, its right to go against the third-party tortfeasor and recover that money is already extinguished. So that might not be fair either, and I'm not trying to compare apples and oranges. I think I'm comparing apples and apples. We talk about whether this statute is fair or not. And to further quote on what's fair and what isn't fair, what's equitable, what isn't equitable, the seminal case of Mulder versus Acme Cleveland Corporation, 95 Wisconsin 2nd 173, which this court decided in 1980 and which this court felt was so important and seminal that it quoted in Kafka at page 507. Workers' compensation laws constitute an all-pervasive legislative scheme which attempts to effect a compromise between the employer and the employee's competing interests. The worker is benefited by certain recovery irrespective of his own fault and irrespective of the employer's absence of fault. Additionally, the workers' compensation legislation abrogated an employer's common law defenses of contributory negligence. So we talk about competing interests here. With workers' compensation laws in this state, as Justice Bradley pointed out, have been around since 1911. They were effected as a compromise. The effect of that compromise is that the workers' compensation, the injured claimant, gets his or her money regardless of whether or not she's at fault. She's got instant money. The employer, on the other hand, doesn't have to worry about facing a lawsuit with an undefined ceiling to it. There's a ceiling to what the workers' compensation carrier has to pay, which is why we have Kafka and why we have Johnson saying that the workers' compensation carrier in a third-party case can only recover payments for which it had liability. And again, going back to Justice Bradley's question about is it defined, is claim as used in that statute defined narrowly or broadly? It must be defined narrowly, because that statute has to be read in